Welcome to Brain and Yvette. We are delighted to be joined by one of our favorite guests, Travis Timmerman, and we're going to be talking about the film Infinity Pool. Travis, would you like to tell us a bit about it?
Yeah, sure. And I will start with just a bit about it because there is a lot that goes on in this film. But it starts off with this character, James Foster, who is a failed novelist. He wrote one poorly received book that didn't sell well either. And he's on vacation with his heiress wife, M, in this fictional country called Latoka. And he's there to try to find inspiration to write his new novel. Now, while on vacation, they meet this other couple where Mia Goth plays a character named Gabby, who claims to be a fan of the novel that James published. And she strokes his ego to insert herself into his life. They end up having dinner and she convinces him to go leave the compound that the resort is on into the country to get drunk and have a fun night. James and his wife do this. They go out as couples. He drives back inebriated and hits and kills a local townsperson. Now, his immediate response, quite naturally, is to try to call the police. Seemingly, he has the right sort of dispositions. But he's told by Gabby that this country is morally backwards and they need to just get in the car and get back to their hotel. So she convinces him to do that pretty quickly. In this moment of panic, he sees this person lying in the road who's dead, gets in the car, drives back, they get back into the hotel. The next day, he's arrested. He's brought into a police station where they're in militarized outfits, and they tell him that the punishment for what he did is death by the hands of the son of his victim. But there's an interesting loophole. If you're a kind of rich Westerner that's visiting the country, instead of getting killed yourself, you can pay a certain fee and they will clone you, and then your clone will die by the hands of your son. And then the only additional catch for you is you have to sit there and watch. So of course, James does this. He pays the fee. They clone him in a sort of horrific montage. And then he watches his clone get stabbed to death brutally by a young child who's the son of his victim.
So an interesting question is, given that the clone is a clone, so not the original James who ran someone over, does the clone deserve the punishment, the brutal killing at the hand of the son of the victim? And then another interesting question is, does this the son of the victim deserve or have the right to inflict some sort of retribution on someone? And does it really matter to them whether it's the clone or not? Because the clone has the same dispositions, the same memories, the same personality as the perpetrator of the murder, as the murderer.
Yeah, these are great questions. I think it's worth distinguishing initially what people intuitively want to say, and then maybe what they'd want to say when they think through certain variations of these cases. Because the thing that's intuitive to say in these cases is not necessarily something that seems plausible when you think through what the implications of these commitments are. Just one thing that I like about the film is it raises certain thought experiments that illustrate what might be potentially problematic about these ideas. Okay, so first, I think people are going to be inclined to say that it does matter whether it's the clone or the person who actually hit and killed the local. I mean, now this idea that it's being causally responsible that matters for dessert. So I will give my students a case like this when we talk about moral luck. Imagine two people get inebriated and they both drive home. And one of them takes a route where there happens to be no pedestrians, so they manage to get home safe. The other person takes a route where there just happens to be a pedestrian that is crossing the street on their path and they hit and kill that pedestrian. If they had been sober, they wouldn't have. But the same thing is true of the person who managed to get home without hitting anyone. If there was a pedestrian in their way, they would have run over and killed them too. they made the same choice to get drunk and drive. And it was just, in an important sense, a matter of luck that one of them happened to have to take a path home where they hit and killed a person. My students think the one that actually hit and killed the person is the one that should be punished. Or at least that's their initial response. But it's unclear why the extent to which you deserve to be punished should depend so much on luck. Because in this case, the only difference between the two people, the one that hit and killed someone and the one that got home safely, was this matter of luck. And my students also don't want to say, they don't want to say luck determines whether you should go to jail, have your life ended, feel guilty for the rest of your life, or anything along those lines. Right? But those two things are incompatible. So you have to go one way or the other. All right. So that's the first thing. I'll say one more thing about this, and then I'm curious to hear what you two think. Here's a case to say that it's the dispositions that matter, not being causally responsible. Suppose there's an innocent person in a house. They're going to exit either through their front door or their back door. And there's two murderers. They're both there. They both have the aim of killing the innocent person. And the person walks out the front door and the murderer there kills him in the front door. The person standing by the back door was intending to do the same thing. They went there. It was premeditated. They had the same sorts of dispositions. They had the same sort of heinous attitudes that would motivate them to do this terrible thing. And when I give that case to my students, a lot of them think, well, they both deserve equal punishment. Yes, one of them actually murdered the other person, but they were both trying to do the same thing, important sense. And then they should go to prison for life. That seems to be their sorts of judgment. So in that case, and I don't know if my students are representative of the population at large, but in that case, they think, same punishment in virtue of the dispositions that they have. And in the drunk driving case, they give a different answer. And you can't have it both ways. I think maybe the case for the dispositions is a bit stronger, if there is such a thing as dessert.
Couple of responses. The one regarding the two murderers, I would think it makes a difference whether the two murderers act in concert with each other. So if they're part of the same gang and they say, let's surround the house, and one of them performs the act, but the other collaborates, then you could say under some doctrine of common purpose, they should both be held liable. But assume they act independently. Assume that you've just got the opportunistic murderer who's looking to club people on the head and steal their stuff, and the one is successful in doing it because someone exits that door, and the other one is unsuccessful in doing it. Then I think our intuitions are that the person who didn't commit the murder, even though they had malice in their heart and had all the wish in the world to kill someone and take their stuff, doesn't get punished. I think if you have a dispositions account, then we're looking at a minority report style situation where we don't have to look at, did you perform a crime? We just have to say, would you perform a crime? Let's have preventative punishment. Let's go and evaluate people as much as we can in advance and say, you seem to have the propensity for committing a violent act or a theft or whatever it is. Let's incarcerate you now. And that would be sufficient for the punishment and satisfies the kind of consequentialist end of less bad happening in the world by these bad people. But definitely doesn't hit the deontologist account that you only should be punished for things that you did that you deserve to be punished for. And so I think to tie it back to the infinity pool case, it seems somehow unfair to punish the clone who has the negative dispositions of the kind of person who would hit and run, but didn't actually perform the act. And I think that's where the discomfort rightly sits in. We feel that this person is innocent. They didn't actually perform the act. They might believe they did. They might be the kind of person who would do it again, but those aren't good reasons for actually punishing them.
Yeah, I see the different views. I don't think they would neatly map onto consequentialist and deontological views. I think whether you're a consequentialist or deontologist, you could accept either of these views about dessert. Yeah, so I feel the pull of that. So one question is, what do you say about the unfairness charge, that it's a matter of luck that one of them managed to perform the act and the other one didn't? And the other response is to say, yeah, I feel the first order intuitions in the case you give, but then I can give seemingly structurally identical cases that push intuitions in the other way. So imagine that there's two assassins that are not working together, and they both pull and rather than stabbing someone to death, they're pulling a trigger on a gun and shooting a person. And one bullet hits the target and kills them milliseconds before the other bullet does. But the second bullet, the person's already dead by the time that bullet goes through. So there's only one of them that killed. It doesn't seem obvious to me that it's unfair for whichever assassin happened to be the one that pulled the trigger a millisecond later to get the same punishment as the person that actually managed to pull a millisecond earlier and be the one that caused the death of the person. They're both were disposed to and tried to do the same thing. And one of them succeeded and the other one failed as a matter of luck.
Travis, sorry, Mark, you want to do a follow-up?
Yeah, so I think it's a nice case. One way you could resolve it is by having things like inchoate crimes, where for a reason of luck, you're unable to complete it, but you get very far down the road. And because of your attempt to perform it, we then punish you. Let's say the assassin shoots just above your head, for example. We could say it's attempted murder and you should be charged with attempted murder. If I survive, then you shouldn't get the penalty of actually having murdered me because you didn't, but you did something pretty bad, which is try to kill me. And you're just lucky that the wind blew the bullet up. In those cases where you've got the two people firing independently of each other and the one happens to hit before the other, it seems like you might end up handing out similar penalties, but for different charges, that the one is liable for murder and the one is liable for attempted murder. And you might want some kind of discretion in sentencing to be able to take that into account, because I agree with you, there's some amount of luck that seems like it shouldn't play a role in the moral balancing. But it just also seems like we're lucky and unlucky all the time, and that the universe isn't fair, and sometimes bad things happen, sometimes good things happen, and we don't think there should be a total recalibration. And I don't think we want to punish the drunk drivers if they had negligently killed someone when they didn't. But you might want to charge them with this liability offense of drunk driving while recognizing you're lucky you didn't hit anyone, so you don't warrant the same level of punishment as someone who did, but you deserve some level of punishment. But all of these cases are different from the clone who hasn't done a thing. That person didn't perform any actions. They're just born into the world with the belief that they performed an action. They thought that they killed someone in a drunk driving incident. They didn't. So it seems like there's no reason to punish them whatsoever. And furthermore, it's compounded by the idea of the truly guilty person getting away with it. Unless we think that the correct punishment in the circumstances when you negligently kill someone isn't the death penalty, but it's to feel some high level of trauma, which is to watch a clone of you being brutally murdered. That's the kind of thing that should shake you and deter you from ever doing another bad thing again. Of course, that's not how the movie goes.
Yes. Let me just say briefly in response to your first point that those all sound like good legal considerations and use the phrase like the world is not fair, which seems true, and it's impossible to construct laws and a justice system that's going to make everything. So I think those sorts of laws that allow for that type of discretion and those sorts of difference in the severity of crimes given the actual outcomes that doesn't take into account luck is what you should do legally, especially because since we can't know what the relevant counterfactuals are, there's no way to account for luck in the system. But questions about what people deserve has to take fairness into account. And there, I think if there is such a thing as desert, it would have to depend on what you were disposed to do rather than what you actually did to properly account for moral law, even though that can't be done in the law. And then to your second point, that's absolutely right. That's not what happens in the system or in the movies. James and his wife both watch his clone, or what appears to be his clone, be brutally murdered by James's victim's son, who's unnamed in the film. And she is horrified by that. She has a response that most audience members think that they would have in that situation. And she packs up and tries to leave immediately. James claims to be unable to find his passport and unable to go with her, so he tells her she can go without him. She wants to get out of there as quickly as possible, and this whole thing has scarred her for life. We later find out that James has hidden his passport because he wants to stay longer. And Mia Goth's character, Gabby, introduces him to a group of her friends with these other kind of rich Westerners who see this as a sort of loophole to go do any crime that you want and then be able to get away with it scot-free. The second part of the film revolves around her and her group trying to get James to go along with them, to go around and commit a series of heinous crimes. and then just pay money to have clones killed over and over. So they see it as like a holiday free from morality, where you can just go indulge in your sort of like worst impulses, your worst violent and sexual impulses, without facing any sort of repercussions.
So I just don't share the intuition that either of you have in this case, that the clone didn't perform the murder. I don't understand why you say that. So the kind of case that I have in mind is, imagine I'm going about my day and I murder someone, and I'm the kind of creature that every so often splits in two. So I perform mitosis spontaneously every week. So I split in two. It seems if I murdered someone earlier during the day, both of those splits are responsible for the murder, right? Would you agree with that? And if you would agree with that, why isn't the clone responsible? You say the clone's not causally responsible. Why not? The clone has all the memories of doing the thing. The clone is identical with the person who did the thing. In what sense is the clone not that person?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think this, what you're pointing to is what I think of as an important difference between what Parfrey would call fission cases and then these cloning cases. So yeah, so let's go back to the fission case that you give. First of all, I do think in cases of fission, both parties would be responsible for the murder. And I actually think both committed the murder. And the reason I say that is, while I'm uncertain of what to say about fission cases, I think it, in cases in which fission is possible, there were two people there all along. Or if there are more ways to cut the brain and maintain consciousness, there are however many ways you could cut the brain and maintain consciousness, however many people they were there initially. But they were closely co-located in space and time, so they're unaware that it's that there's more than one person contained in the skull. So
that's a weird view, Travis, because then what you're saying is that at any given time, because we could chop the brain up a thousand different ways, but there's thousands of you in you that are unrealized.
Yeah, I don't think we can do that given the way our brains actually work and how quickly we lose the plasticity as we get older. But okay, in possible but worlds assuming, where you can do that.
Yeah, assuming future humans have very plastic brains because we get treated in such a way that we take these drugs that our brains are super plastic, and you can divide them up like you do with a cactus, right? And it just grows into the original. You'd be like, okay, there's potentially an infinite number of people in you.
Yeah, if it's infinitely divisible, then yeah. And that is definitely a weird view. But the world is weird sometimes, and I think it is less weird than the alternatives. Or it's subject to fewer very serious objections than any of the alternative views are.
Okay, let's put aside the weirdness of the view. I think you've given me everything I want then. Because now let's think about the process involved in fission, which is you go into the brain, you chop it up, this piece of matter, and you implant it in two different bodies, right? So that's the process. And let's think about the process of duplication that happens in the film. So we don't know exactly how it works in the film, but it's this weird room that you get placed in. You effectively get put into a mold, and then another mold is made that's very similar. You lose consciousness at some point. There is an interesting question in the film of whether it's you who wakes up as the clone or you who wakes up as the original. But the point is, it seems pretty irrelevant to moral considerations of desert and punishment what the particular mechanism was that was used. It seems pretty irrelevant whether you were put into a mold and then another one was made and then your consciousness was transferred in a certain way, or whether certain parts of your brain instead were transferred. Why is any of that relevant to moral considerations about whether you should be punished or not? Surely, and considerations of whether you performed the action. Because on your view, if you're split, both splits perform the action. I'm saying the technology should make no difference. All that matters is, do you have a memory of doing the action, performing the action? That's what matters. And in this case, you do. And so you're morally responsible and you perform the action.
Yeah. So I agree with you, but I'm going to play devil's advocate. Yeah. The first thing is, there's a question about whether the clone in fact did it. And I think in the clone case, the clone did not drive over and kill the pedestrian because the clone didn't exist. So say this isn't part of the narrative of the film, but suppose the running over the clone was on a Tuesday, just making it up that it was on a Tuesday. They don't say what day it is. And then the clone came into existence on Wednesday. So why didn't the clone run over and kill the person? Because that happened on Tuesday and they didn't exist on Tuesday. But in the fission case, I think if you take my view about what fission amounts to, both of those people did exist on Tuesday if you have a fission. So that's what I want to say, just descriptively,
but,
it's not.
But what do you mean that they didn't exist? What do you mean they didn't exist?
The
I think
clone?
They did. I think, yeah. Are you saying there wasn't a separate body the day before? Sure, there wasn't a separate body, but they, as in the person responsible, that person existed.
There wasn't any physical material that gave rise to the consciousness of the clone house. That hadn't come into existence yet.
Why do we care about that? It's not the physical material that's responsible.
Yeah, so, right. So that's a good question. So there's a question about whether it's descriptively true that the clone ran over the person. And there's a question about whether that matters more. Okay, so I am inclined to agree with you that it does not matter morally. But here's the sort of devil's advocate position. Someone might say, look, you can't be subject to what are called world-imposed blame dilemmas, right? There's something unfair about just coming into the world and then being deserved to be punished when there's no act that you could have performed that would have prevented you from deserving such punishment. And when you say that the clone is responsible for the murder, you're putting them in this blame dilemma. Whereas the original is not in a blame dilemma because there's something he could have done that would have prevented him from deserving all of this punishment. And that is not drive drunk and then end up killing a person.
So I've got a couple of thoughts. The one is, let's say we're thinking about a murder weapon and you off an assembly line, there's a bunch of AK-47s that get made and they use particular AK-47 to kill someone. And we think the particular murder weapon matters. It's not sufficient to locate some alternative identical AK-47 and say, that's the murder weapon. That can only target the one that was actually used in a murder. And I would think that the same goes with regards to the clone. I think it does seem that who performed the act and who is morally responsible, those two questions might come apart because you might have a different question about who ought to be punished. And so if we think that the punishment is partly to discharge a debt, that the original performs the murder, the clone pops into existence, and assume that we think that our model of punishment is punish those people that are capable of doing that bad stuff, then just killing the clone doesn't solve the problem, because it seems like in the cloning process, what you've done is double the amount of blameworthiness, but only mete out half the amount of punishment. And so it seems that there's an injustice that occurs in not killing both of them, if you think the death penalty is the right answer in the circumstance, that you could never escape the moral debt through the cloning process because you'd always be generating more and more blameworthiness in the world and only removing some of it.
Yeah, that seems right. Initially, I thought of this as, oh, it's just a sci-fi version of rich people having whipping boys. We have someone else take your punishment. But in one way, it might be less bad than that if Jason and I are right that if there is such a thing as desert, you deserve it in virtue of these dispositions. But yeah, to your point, Mark, it's not giving everyone their just desserts because they're still the original person that doesn't get what they deserve, assuming that you deserve to be punished for culpable wrongdoing.
I'm not sure I have a dispositional view though, Travis, because my view is still consistent with the idea that you should be punished based on what you did. And I think the clone did it.
Yeah, but why do you think the clone, how could the clone do something before they even existed?
Because they did exist. When you say they, do you mean their body or do you mean them, their identity?
The person who is the clone.
Yeah, that person who is the clone existed before they were cloned, because the person is causally continuous with psychologically continuous, causally continuous with the person from which they were cloned.
Yeah, I have a hard time understanding existence in that way. Suppose it's true that I'm going to be cloned in 10 years from now, in 2033. Let's say my clones don't exist yet, but they will exist in 10 years. That sounds felicitous to me, but you have to say that is wrong and my clones do exist if they're in fact going to come into existence in the future?
On my view, there's an ambiguity between on the word they. So the ambiguity is by they, do you mean that mind? Or by they, do you mean the body? And sure, that body doesn't exist yet, 100%. That body didn't exist yesterday. But it's not the body that commits the murder. It's the mind.
But the mind doesn't exist either. There's a introspectively like indistinguishable atom for atom, mental state for mental state match of the mind that's going to exist in 10 years right now. But that mind doesn't exist. I think that mind will come into existence when the cloning process
happens. So on my view, the minds only diverge once they are dissimilar. So on my view, the minds become two distinct minds when the second mind, the cloned mind, starts having its own thoughts and experiences that are distinct from the first.
Yeah. Okay. So let's take a variation of Parfit's teletransporter case and tell me what you think would be prudent to do in this situation. Suppose you get in the teletransporter and the way it works is like in Star Trek. So it takes a copy of your body and then it takes physical atoms in whatever location you're being transported to, and then it arranges them in the exact same structure, which is going to, let's suppose, give rise to the exact same mental conditions. So the minds will be indistinguishable. And you are going to be transported into a virtual reality, let's suppose, that will look both identical for you and the clone of you that's created. Sorry, so I'm not explaining this well, but suppose you get in this cloning booth, you can't see anything except the white walls of the cloning booth, and then you're going to step out of the cloning booth and you'll be in like a virtual reality, and your clone that's going to be cloned in some other part of the world, they're going to step out in the same virtual reality. So the thing that I'm going for is that your experiences will be identical phenomenologically, both you and your clone. As seems imprudent to me for you to kill yourself, even though there's going to be a clone of you that's having the exact same psychological experiences that you would be having. And if I understand you correctly, you have to think that your mind still exists in the other virtual reality. You have no reason not to off your physical mind in the original Jason body.
That's a lovely case.
Is that right? Is that an implication of your view?
That's a lovely case. It's almost good enough for me to change my mind. Yeah, it's very close. As you were setting up the case, the way I thought you were going to set up the case is there's two minds, one going about the physical world and one going about a virtual world that's meant to be identical to that physical world. And then would there be any value in saying that they're two minds rather than one? And you've cashed that out in terms of suicide, which is quite interesting. It's a very interesting case. Basically, what I want to do there is bite the bullet and say, look, the case is so bizarre that our intuitions here are not clear, etc. But I do feel the pull of the argument. I think it's very interesting.
Yeah, thanks. I'll say one more thing about this little shop. The case is certainly bizarre, but the world is bizarre. I made that one up on the spot, but we might live in a world where there's multiple universes and maybe every logically possible universe is realized, and many of those, perhaps an infinite number, will contain versions of you where your life is introspectively indistinguishable. The things that are different in that world are just not affecting you or not interacting with you in any way. And if cosmologists were to say that this were true or discover that is true, that would seem to imply that you would have no prudential reason to continue living on this world. And that seems like a maybe more realistic case in some way, but the same sort of what I think of as an implausible consequence, because the physical brain in your skull that's giving rise to your consciousness is distinct from the other physical brains that give rise to consciousness in other possible worlds.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree. I think it doesn't matter that the cases are strange cases because it's testing a particular intuition, which is, would you value yourself as a discrete entity? So you know that you're multiply realized, but you don't actually experience the world that way. You're not looking out of the world through both sets of eyes, only through your own. Even if you have the knowledge that your seat of consciousness could move between the two and it would be identical, you still care about the one that you're in, and that seems to matter. I also think it seems implausible to say that the clone was always there. It seems like the clone has a birthday, which is the day it was cloned. It's true that it carries all your prime memories through and is born with a kind of Korean age, in the sense that its biological age doesn't match its mental age. It's one day old, but appears to be 35-year-old Skarsgård. But Yeah. What I wonder about, something we didn't get to fully talk about, is the sense of, if your purpose of punishment is to punish those who are likely to perform actions in the disposition account, then it seems like you've got to bite the minority report bullet. Jason doesn't have to, because he just says, no, the clone is the person that did it. And so he's only punishing beings that he said causally did it, but he's got a weird causal account. You're going to say, no, we can punish the clone because it's the kind of being that's going to perform bad things. But then are you happy to punish other beings who might perform bad things? Stephen Kirshner, in one of our prior episodes on dystopian technology, thought the difficulty with assigning blame based on risk is that you might end up doing some things that we think of as quite repugnant. So if you were doing a survey on someone and said people who like you are highly disposed to performing crimes because of your age or the country that you live in or the friends that you keep, your ethnic background, whatever it is, therefore we're going to punish you, that seems distasteful. And maybe the clones in that kind of situation, they haven't done anything bad. They weren't cause responsible for the death. They just really do resemble someone who did do that in a much stronger way than, let's say, in the ethnic or age grace. But are you happy to push it down the line for the others?
Yeah. So I'll say the reasonable thing first, and then I'll say the wacky view that I have after it. So the reasonable thing that I think is true is, yeah, it would be disastrous to try to have a system where you punish people based on the likelihood that they would do wrong, beyond the fact that it would inevitably be exploited to punish people on the basis of their prejudice or bigotry. There's just no way to do it accurately. Even if you were able to give a sort of accurate assessment about probability, the dispositional account that I would accept, if there is such a thing as desert, is one where it's a question of what you would in fact do, not just what you would probably. So if the future were open and there's no fact of the matter about whether you would do something until you're in that situation, then I think what matters is whether you in fact do it. But if, say, you have free will and determinism is true, then I think it would be fine to punish people on the basis of what they would in fact do, even if they haven't done it, just if they were in the situation. Okay. Now, I do have some concerns about that, and I'm skeptical about whether anyone deserves to suffer in general. But if I accepted an account of desert, that would be the one that's most plausible. Now, here's the sort of wacky thing. You asked if I would bite the minority bullet report. Yep. The problem with the system in Minority Report is that the precogs were manipulating Tom Cruise's character by selectively showing certain things to make him do something that wasn't in fact bad. So that was the problem. But if they were good precogs that were giving you all the relevant information and they were indeed perfectly accurate, what's the problem with that? I don't see what the problem with that is. Now, that might sound wacky, but I think the reason that the narrative unfolded in the way it did is because they wanted to come up with some reason that this would be a really terrible system. And they couldn't come up with a reason if it worked perfectly. So the reason that they come up with was the precogs would be prisoners that would be exploiting people by giving misleading information and showing select predictions about what would happen to give people false beliefs and then free themselves. So yeah, I would bite the minority report bullet if it worked in the way that it was supposed to. And it seems like doesn't seem like that big a bullet to bite to me.
Seems like there's two really important questions here, which we haven't really fleshed out. And you both mentioned them in passing, but it seems like you're making certain assumptions on both, which not everyone would share, which I don't share. So the first question is around the seat of consciousness, that as Mark described it. So is there a mental substrate? Is there a mental basis that watches all the experiences that you have in life? So when you feel sad, there is this mental substrate that feels that sadness. And when something happens, you have a car accident, that mental substrate watches the car accident happen. They experience it. So I deny the mental substrate. For me, what a person is, they're a bundle of experiences, mental experiences, and there's no substrate that experiences that bundle. There's just the bundle. And so that's why my view pops up, right? Which is that if there's two identical bundles, two mental bundles, there's nothing that distinguishes them of importance in the way that two physical bundles that exist in different space-times would have a difference. So that's the first important question. The second important question is, are we determined to act on our dispositions in a certain way? If we are, then it makes perfect sense to punish us based on those dispositions. So if I have the disposition to commit the murder and pull the trigger, then, and the world is set up in such a way that those dispositions determine me to pull the trigger, then it seems perfectly reasonable to punish me before I pull the trigger or after with the same punishment, because it's determined that I'm going to do the same thing. But if the world is not determined in that way, and even given those dispositions, I could choose or land up acting differently, then it seems that the punishment is no longer reasonable. And so it seems like your views only go through on certain answers to those two questions.
Yeah, that's really good. I think I lost the thread in the second question, so I want to come back to that. With respect to the first question, yeah, I think I am taking that on as a background assumption. And I don't have a good argument for that. I should say, I don't know what the right view is. And I'm like slightly more confident in this than alternative views, but it's such a low credence that I wouldn't even say I think it's my view is very likely to be true. I just have a higher credence in it than a lot of the many alternatives that are on the off, that are on offer. So yeah, that's, I think, a plausible place to push me, and I'd have to think about it more. And if I can't justify that assumption, then I would just lower my credence in that view even more and become more agnostic about what the right view is. Okay. The second thing, I thought I was following you until it seemed like we were disagreeing, but I think I agree with you. So if we're determined to do something and we can act freely, then it does make sense for us to be punished in virtue of the dispositions. And then presumably if we cannot act freely and we're determined, then I would think it doesn't make sense for us to be punished, because then no one would deserve to be punished in virtue of lacking free will. Is that right? Does that seem true?
So that's an interesting corollary of what I'm saying. Yeah. But I think we live in a libertarian free world, not in the political sense, but in the free world sense, where we have all these dispositions and yet we could land up acting differently from what those dispositions push, from where those dispositions push us to act. So I have the disposition to pull the trigger. I have the desire to pull the trigger. I have all the reasons in the world to pull the trigger. And yet something in me steps in and says, no, I'm not going to pull that trigger, in a way that's undetermined. And so given that, even if you know all my prior dispositions, because they don't determine my action on my account of the world, you wouldn't be entitled to punish me based on those dispositions alone.
Yeah. Okay. So I agree with that. So that's another qualification that I should have made in my initial claim, where I was assuming that if you're disposed to do something, you would in fact do it in that situation. If the future is actually open, and there's, at least with respect to free actions, and there's only very high probabilities about what you would, or what you might do in various situations, then yeah, I would agree. It would have to depend on whether you in fact do it, not whether you're disposed to do it. Because if it's free, you always have some disposition to not do it in that situation as well. And not even God or some omniscient being would be able to tell you what you do in that situation, because there's no fact of the matter until you're there. Anyway, yeah, that's a long way of saying, yeah, I agree, I think, with that point.
So I'm going to throw the cat amongst the pigeons for Jason. His moral account is probabilistic utilitarianism. So you should do that action which is likely to lead to the best consequences, not what actually does. And so I think one of the reasons why people are uncomfortable with the Minority Report case is exactly because they believe in libertarian free will. They think, you know, even if there's a good reason to think that you might go and perform this action, you didn't do it yet and you could always do otherwise. Let's assume you could do otherwise, but the odds are really in favor of you doing the bad thing. And assume that we live in a world where it's become much, much easier for us to work out who those people are who are going to do the bad things. If you think about how much information people feed into social media, the kinds of Chinese-style social credit scores, why not have a system which basically says, look, once your credit score goes below a certain threshold and we have enough information on you to think that the likelihood of you performing a bad action is in excess of 75%, whatever it is, if you think the threshold is, then we are not really punishing you, but we're going to inflict some kind of harm on you that would curtail your ability to perform the action. We're going to imprison you in advance. So it's not that you deserve to be imprisoned. It's just that we're going to treat you as if you were like a disease, and that there's a likelihood that you would spread to others and that you would cause this harm. And so we're going to enforce these kind of curtailment measures. And the determinist thinks that's what all punishment is, because no one would deserve anything, they couldn't do otherwise. And so when lock people up or give them fines or whatever it is, it's just a mechanism for controlling a disease-like thing, that all people are just like viruses spreading around, and the way to curb them is through these interventions. And so I wonder if you think that's what you ought to do in the circumstance, is look at the data, maximize the good, impose the measures.
I really like the case. And I think what it pushes me to say is that it would be right for the state to do that, although I'm not a fan of states, and this is partly the reason why. It would be right for the state to do that, and at the same time, you don't deserve the punishment. So they could both be true simultaneously, which definitely involves a tension. I get that. There's a tension in that view, because you'd like the obligations of states or people or organizations to match up with desert of the people that they're acting on. It would be a nice world where that was the case. I think I have to bite the bullet and say sometimes those come apart.
So basically, you're going to follow the lock her up line, hey? You want Hillary behind bars, even though you couldn't find the dirty emails, because you know what she's supposed to do.
Yeah, but this assumes we have excellent knowledge of people's predispositions, right? So this assumes that we really get into their heads. We have the computer in their head that assesses all their thoughts all the time. We have perfect information about what kinds of thoughts generally result in what kinds of behaviors. We have very high probability readings. We just don't live in such a world.
Thank goodness we aren't all carrying around listening devices that tell maybe big tech, not big government, what we're thinking, what we're doing, what all our thoughts and desires are. Sometimes we even broadcast that out to more people than just our WhatsApp contact list. I don't know. I wouldn't bet on it not being, maybe we're not there now, but it seems like a pretty good Black Mirror episode for 5 years.
It is. And I do think that we actually make these judgments all the time, right? So we hear what people say on social media and then we judge them. We say that's the kind of person that is an X person, and it would be best if they died in a plane crash. You often see this kind of thing on social media. So we do make those judgments. I just think the problem with those judgments is that they're judging on incomplete information. So it could be that we only represent a certain percentage of ourselves on our phones. But in the world where we put all of ourselves in, where we give the whole story of ourselves, and the state had access to that and could very reliably predict what we're going to do, then maybe. But maybe the world is composed such that, and maybe people are constructed such that they're highly undetermined, that people surprise the system all the time. They break the probabilities all the time. There's lovely data on predictions, and they find that predictions, they can be okay a year from now about how society is going to work and how political actors are going to behave. Once you start getting beyond a year from now, the best predictions all fail. And it could just be that humans are pretty chaotic. And given that, if you assume that view of humans, then that system won't match up with what really happens.
So I've got a further question for Travis. There's a thing you mentioned earlier, this idea that you could have multiple beings inside of you in the fissure case, different seats of consciousness, different personalities maybe. And that's something that's explored in Infinity Pool in a quite surreal, strange way. So there's sequences where they do a kind of mystical drug, where they start to hallucinate. There's a scene where James Foster captures someone who's got a bag around his head, and he beats that person, thinking that it's someone. And then when the bag is removed, he finds out that it's his clone. There's a scene where his clone is led around like a dog, like an animal. And then he's encouraged by the others to kill the animal, which he does. And it seems like part of this is this idea that there are aspects of yourself that could be exercised through a kind of spiritual process. So people will think that, like, through an ayahuasca trip or a meditation session or therapy, that you can take the animistic side and you can confront it, maybe in a very uncomfortable way, and then you can surpass it. So I wonder what you think about that. Are those just nice bits for fiction and they're entertaining to watch? Do you think that there's any kind of reality to the idea that we have these separate, distinct aspects to ourselves that maybe are like other beings?
Yeah. So first, with respect to the narrative, I think that is a very plausible interpretation about what's going on with this character. And it's interesting that in many ways he's doing this. I think the writer, Cronenberg, and Skarsgård, the actor, would both describe themselves as doing this to himself, which I think Jason would accept literally. I would think he's not doing it to himself. He's doing it to a clone. But if this is something that's going on in his imagination, or if it's a dream, which is alluded to in the film multiple times, then there's a reading in which he is battling these different facets of his personality, destroying his ego in the process, and then building it up again. It ends with him destroying his personality and being reborn. So you see him at the beginning of the film, as I mentioned, he was a failed writer. He's very depressed about his lack of success. His marriage is not going well. He's been married for a decade, but his wife belittles him and says that she married him because she was rich and could finance him. And she alludes to marrying him to rebel against what her father wanted, who was a writer himself. Then he goes through the process where he watches his clone die. Then he's tricked into beating his clone, as you mentioned. And then in the climax of the film, he's a clone of him that's referred to as the dog, as you mentioned, is brought out, who's this basically the id. It's just this very like animalistic, literally walking on all fours, grunting, like nonverbal, and then attacks him. And then he quite viciously ends up in self-defense, just punching this dog clone of him in the face over and over again until he smashes through the skull. And the film ends with his fist just covered in blood. And Mia Goth's character comes and then takes his hand, opens her blouse, wipes his bloody hand on her chest, and then starts breastfeeding him. So it's so on the nose that it's, I think, detracting from the narrative quality of the film. But it's like quite literally showing you him destroying his id and then being reborn and following Mia Goth's character as a sort of maternal figure. And then the film ends with him strangely getting on this bus with all of these sort of Westerners that were going there to do grossly immoral acts and get away with it. And you just see him separated from everyone else. He's sitting in the back in the center, and then everyone else is sitting in front of him on different sides of the bus. And after they just went on this holiday to murder a bunch of people, they're having the most mundane, boring conversations about, oh no, I have to get back to work, and I think I'm going to redecorate the house, and like maybe I'll paint the walls. And just this sort of like completely anodyne, like unbelievably boring conversations. And they're just able to transition back to that right away. And you can see the James character is not able to do that. He just sits there dejected for the whole ride back. Then at the airport, they say goodbye to him and say, we hope we'll see you next year. Now that he's reborn into being one of them, I think they expect him to come back and do this. And he doesn't get on the flight and go home. He's permanently changed. The very last shot of the film is him back at the resort sitting in this rainstorm, which is something that had also been alluded to throughout the film. There's a festival that's happening, and they keep saying like this is going to happen before the like big stormy season, which is also something else that happens that's like pretty, you know, on the nose. So that's that stuff in the writing bothered me. I'm curious to see what Jason thinks about that as a sci-fi writer himself. But because it's so on the nose, it's really easy to see what they're going for philosophically in the film.
Yeah, I think the strength of the film is the philosophical first half, where this thought experiment is set up, and there's these fascinating questions about personal identity. Which one are you, the clone or not the clone? Does the clone deserve things? The moral questions. These are great questions. And then they run out of steam. And then the question is, so what do we talk about now? And then it becomes a psychological tale, which you might see as a solution to the philosophical problem. So the philosophical problem posed, at least one of them, is who am I? And the psychological answer at the end is, I'm the person who rules the id. So I come into existence when I destroy my id and dominate over my desires, my base instincts. Maybe that's the sort of solution proposed. But I agree with you. It's on the nose. The first half of the film is not, it's not very metaphorical. It's quite literal. These things happen. And the second half of the film becomes absurd if you understand it literally. It's much more metaphorical. And I think that shift in tone from the literal to the metaphorical is very jarring in a way that's not pleasant to watch. And so the second half of the film, I think, fails. But the first half of the film is unbelievable. And I recommend anyone who's listening watches it. It's just so good, so clever. These are just great questions.
Yeah, I should say, like, I raise these complaints, but it's still one of the best films that I've seen this year. It'll probably be one of the best films that I will have seen all year. I agree with everything you said, except I wonder whether everything is supposed to be understood metaphorically, even though the first half of the film is filmed in a way that's very, that looks very literal. It's not surreal at all. And the second half of the film is very surreal. But it's alluded to throughout the film that this is just happening in his mind in terms of a dream. So it actually opens with what sounds like a nonsensical sentence. It opens with M saying to James, you said you can't feed yourself with white sand brain death. And then he's saying, what are you talking about? And then says he can't tell if he's asleep or awake. The next day when they're having breakfast, he asks where he is, says he can't survive a dinner in this town, when she asks him to go to this Chinese restaurant. And then he says, does anyone even think this is a real town? Why would they have a Chinese place? So like the literal reading of that is he's asking why they would have a Chinese place in a small island. And there's something that's odd about this town. It should be seen as foreshadowing for what's to come. But the other reading of it is, the character is telling you that none of this is actually real and this is just going on in his head. When M has the normal response to watching a clone of her husband, James, die, and he doesn't. He just sits there, she says, like a robot and watches it and then seems drawn to it in this way, drawn into this battle. She's leaving and he's staying and she's saying this would make more sense if this were a dream than if it were reality. So I think there's a reading of the film where the whole thing is supposed to be metaphorical, but it's very weird because, as you point out, the first half is not surreal in any sort of way. It's almost like a completely different film. If I were just watching it, it's almost like a completely different film than the second half, which delves into this Cronenberg body horror stuff of ritualistic sex scenes and doing drugs and like weird camera filters to make something seem very far removed from reality. And the first film is not like that at all. But I do think the whole thing is supposed to be what's going on in his mind, this internal battle with himself.
So there's a line that's said by people operating in the clone facility, which is, we don't always make a perfect copy. Sometimes there's little errors. And if you think about it, the film kind of builds that idea throughout. So you mentioned straight away that it's set in a fictional town. They have their own unique writing script. It looks like it's somewhere in Eastern Europe, but you're not quite sure. That you've got this village, which looks like a village, but is actually a simulacra because it's set on a resort. And so throughout, there's always a sense in which there is a distortion of reality that's going on. And maybe if we think about how that goes for the clones, that if each of the clones is not an identical copy, but more like a distorted copy, there's that old Michael Keaton film called Multiplicity, where, you know, he starts cloning himself and then the clones clone each other. And every time it degrades and you wind up with these four different clones who have different personalities, but all resemble Keaton. Maybe that makes a difference, that if these things are non-identical, they're related, they have the same physicality. Maybe they have some of the memories, some of the thoughts, some of the dispositions, but they get more and more distinct from each other to the point where one of them, as you say, is this animal. Just the id that just goes around barking and acting violently, then our sense of them being distinct is going to mean that our sense of moral responsibility must also be distinct, that each of these things is not only not causally connected to prior crimes, but also just happens to look like it. They look more like an effigy in the sense that you might think people are upset with Saddam Hussein, so they burn effigies of him or burn effigies of George Bush, that they know that it's a way of visiting their hatred on a thing that looked like the original, in the way that the child visits his hatred on the what looks like the real killer but isn't the real killer, that it's not doing the work of punishment, it's doing some other kinds of moral work, the idea of being able to express your disdain, and the target is misplaced.
Yeah, that all sounds very plausible to me. And I was thinking about that line right when they said it, I figured that it was going to be important later. And I really like your reading, and maybe that's right. The thing that I was thinking when I initially watched it was that the clone did actually come out identical mental state for mental state. The reason is because when the clone is being killed, he's begging his wife, or what he believes to be his wife, M, for help. But of course, that doesn't entail that the mental states are exactly identical, and that's perfectly consistent with your reading. Then when we see the dog version of him, he's so different. And I wondered, oh, maybe this was like a clone that had gone wrong. But what I ended up thinking, at least on that first viewing, was that Mia Goth's character Gabby and the other tourists had degraded him so much that they had managed to turn him into. They got an identical clone and they managed to just degrade him so much they turned him into the dog version of himself and then made the original confront and kill that clone. And much of the film, and I think much of the horror of the film, comes from the way that her and her friends are able to so quickly take someone that seemingly has a pretty good and normal life. There's some like strife in their marriage and he's not happy that he's arrived, but these are like pretty minor problems, all things considered. And almost immediately she makes him give up everything that he thought about himself, which is necessary for the narrative of this rebirth. But the horror that you want the viewers to feel when they watch that comes from how quickly she does that. So there's a scene early on when they're all at the beach. They barely know each other. And her husband, Albin, I think is his name, is cooking sausage and saying how he's going to cook and eat James for dinner, and some rather obvious foreshadowing. But then James goes to urinate on a tree somewhere, and Gabby comes and then starts giving him a handjob until he ejaculates. And he just doesn't resist. He doesn't do anything. He's just surprised by that, but he goes along with it. And then they have dinner and she flirts with him. And it's very clear that she is driving this wedge further between him and his wife, who he's been married to for 10 years. And then in a matter of days, he's lost his wife, or he seems to have lost his wife. She's gone along. He's realized that he gets enjoyment, some kind of sick fascination with watching his clone get killed, that he can be very easily manipulated to go kill innocent people, which is what he does the next night on the threat of blackmail to get his passport back. But he has it all along. You find out that at that point of the narrative, you think that he actually lost his passport, then you find out later that he was hiding it. So we realize that he's quickly, without actually being properly blackmailed, going and just murdering innocent people. So he changes so rapidly. So I think the same thing could have happened to the dog character. They could have just degraded that poor guy even further to brought him down to that state, that pure animalistic rage state, and then made them fight for their own sort of sick amusement. But anyway, like both of these readings, I think are consistent with what happens on screen in the film.